Good morning. 6:22 a.m. Wednesday, August 12th, 2015. August the 12th already. Month's almost half over. I made my 5K yesterday. I put in a couple more words in the bank after I made the 5K. It was a good riding day yesterday. It was broken up here and there, but when I managed to sit down and focus, the words came out. I've discovered one of Pip's secrets. One of many Pip's secrets. Pip has a lot of secrets that we don't necessarily know about. So, yeah, 56,000 words this morning to start with. And I'm glad I'm very glad I have put myself in the habit of saving the file when I stand up from the keyboard, because otherwise the system reset in the middle of the night last night would have erased some of those words. But I'm good. So let's see, what else, what do I want to talk about today? Yesterday's topic in the various social media spheres was branding and how setting goals and, you know, some of those business mindset stuff. The thing about branding, and I think I've talked about this before, I'll talk about it again for the new people. If you've heard this spiel before, fast forward to tomorrow. Branding is not exactly something that's in the brander's control. I mean, you can try, you can work toward it, and I certainly do. But it's important to recognize, to realize that the perception of your brand is only, I'm not going to say tangentially, but that's the word that comes to mind. It's only roughly related to what you intend the perception of your brand to be. And we're talking about it in relationship to the idea of trust. Somebody characterized it in a workshop recently as emotional Velcro. And yeah, it's true. It's a very good metaphor, emotional Velcro. And it's a good metaphor because it underscores two important aspects of brand. The idea that once someone has a favorable perception of your brand, it sticks with them. So there's this thing called brand loyalty that's talked about quite frequently in marketing circles. I was hiking along this morning because I came out and it's pretty chilly this morning. It's like 55 and I'm only wearing a polo shirt. But I worked up a sweat in the first mile, and now I'm paying for it by slowing down a little bit so I can talk. And now the shirt is a bit clammish. Anyway, brand loyalty. When there's a positive response to your brand, people tend to trust the brand, at least within the purview, within the narrow scope of aspects of your brand. So, you know, you trust a toothpaste, so you trust the brand. You trust it to do what it says on the tin, as it were. You don't necessarily trust that brand to advise you on, say, what book to read next, or what candidate you should vote for. That's not how brands work. They're limited in scope. And once you have a bad perception of a brand, you don't work with that brand anymore. You don't fly United if they've smashed your guitar. You don't You don't use Arm & Hammer toothpaste if the taste isn't something you can cope with. Or whatever. So this idea of branding is, and emotional Velcro is important because it underscores that in the first place the response is emotional. It's not logical. And that response doesn't come from the person who's trying to foster perceptions of the brand. It's coming from the people who are using the brand. Now, you can try to foster positive emotional response to your brand. You can do some things, and I hope I'm doing some of them, that foster that emotional response, a positive emotional response. And what you have to do is accept the fact that not everybody is going to have the positive emotional response that you want. And once you've got it, it sticks, just like Velcro. You've got a piece of Velcro stapled to your head. It's not coming off. And that brand perception will be stuck there darn near forever. Now, it's possible to reverse, but it's very difficult. Rebranding is a term you hear quite frequently. Oh, I'm going to rebrand my author brand. Yeah. Good luck with that. So, influence, which is why we have branding. Influence to convince people that they should buy your product or pay attention to what you're saying or any of those other indicators of influence. It really has to do with a very fundamental concept of branding, which is trust. They trust your brand to be what your brand is. And it might be easier to think about it in concrete terms, like with cattle brands, which I know I've talked about before. Cattle brands here in the Old West were a way for ranchers to keep their cows sorted out. So if you're all using the same range in the old days, in the open range before settlers came, before barbed wire, it wasn't unusual for cows across a whole bunch of ranches to share the same public lands. And then round up at the end of the summer, they sort the brands out, and that would say who got paid for the steaks. But as it started as simply, that cow's mine, this cow's yours, people in the area started attributing values to those brands. So Rocking Jay knew how to put on a good barbecue, and Bar None had really fine stock. So if you're looking to have a barbecue, you went over to Rocking Jay. If you're looking to expand the quality of your herd or improve the quality of your herd, you went to see if you could wangle a bull off from Bar None. And you didn't turn your back on Lazy W, because you didn't trust those people, ever. So that's sort of the root of modern branding. That's where the term brand comes from. It's where the dynamic involved is most readily observed in ways that makes sense, where you're trying to foster an emotional response, but the guys at what I call it, Lazy W, they didn't really like to be thought of as untrustworthy, and probably it was because they hired people cheap, or they cut some corner that allowed the bad apples in the neighborhood to congregate. And the only alternative was to change the way they do business, and then ultimately to change the Lazy W to Bar M or something. They had to rebrand so that they could disassociate themselves from the negative connotations of the first brand. So branding has to do with modern branding, in modern times, is an author brand has to do with what do you want to be seen as? What do you want to be thought about as? And I'm good being thought about as the anti-Sigler. I'm good about being the guy who doesn't promote, who doesn't buy ads, who's not Monk Post, who's not putting a link every day on his photograph in the morning to show his digital image, to show the link to his somewhat daily podcast. I'm okay being what I hope people think of me as a relatively good writer. And understand that I'm not the guy that you go to for gore. I'm not the guy that you go to for big battle scenes. I'm not the guy that you go to for big, sweeping, political stories of warfare set against the backdrop of the stars. So that would be like David Weber, John Ringo. It's not me. And it's good, because I don't want it to be me. Somebody left a backpack sitting right there. That's not good. So, yeah, there's this this idea of author branding. And you know, the discussion was a good one. I thought the discussion was interesting, because so many people seem to... It's like, oh, well, if I have a good, strong brand, then I'll be able to sell books. No. It's possible to have a good, strong, negative brand, and that's not where you want to be. Particularly when it comes to social media, it's not something that works in your favor. What you need is a brand that your customers, in the case of a writer, your fans, can trust. And that's why I'm very reticent about changing my brand. I'm very very much about not putting my messages in front of anybody who doesn't want to see them. I do post a tweet and a Google Plus post with the daily image, but I only, you know, it's tagged with my hashtag and the weather, and that's it. I when I broke 1,000, I put a little additional blip on it, but generally I don't. And I don't do it because I want my brand, which is, I'm not, you know, I don't want every follower in the world. I only want the people who are interested enough in me to follow up, to find out what's going on, who are intrigued enough by this weather report to take a peek. And yesterday I had an interview with Patrick McLean of How to Succeed at Evil. And he was like, you know, I always saw this. I thought it was, well, that's nice. It's just his weather report. And it wasn't until just the other day, and apparently it was when I broke 1,000, that he realized that, holy crap, this is something deeper. This is a rabbit hole that people can go down. And that's what I want. That's the perception. I want people to see it and go, well, that's nice. And then at some point in time go, holy crap, this has been going on all this time and I had no idea. Oh, wow, this is cool. And cool is good. I like cool. I like being thought of as being cool. I also get, oh, that's lame. How do you expect people to find you? You know, I don't really. The response that infuriates people who think that I should care. that I should make it possible for everybody in the world to find me. No, not really. Every time I do a promotion and one of my books gets a lot of extra attention, I get a lot of extra one-star reviews. Because it's not a book for everyone. It's not, especially the space opera, especially Isthmus of Wong, is widely regarded as a Gary Stu, or the male equivalent of a Mary Sue, someone for whom everything always breaks his way, or for someone who always gets exactly what he wants and everything is golden around him. And the first three books, everything is golden around him, except that it's not exactly what he thinks. So the fact that he thinks it's golden doesn't necessarily mean it's golden, and there are clues in the books that that underscore that what he sees and the way he interprets what he's seeing isn't necessarily the way things are. The clues are there. Having gone through them recently with the paperbacks, and maybe there could have been a few more. There's stuff that's really subtle. But, particularly in the last three books, his world was not as rosy and cheerful. And a big portion of that change in tone and voice, in action, was deliberate and an attempt to show how he changed in his perceptions of what happened in the world. Yes, he still did a lot of things right. Yes, he still did a lot of things wrong, which he thought were right. In most cases, they worked out for him. He did some things that he thought were wrong, that worked out against him, that actually were right, but he still doesn't think that. He still doesn't understand that a dogma is not a good philosophy of life. Because life has a way of happening despite what we might believe. So yeah, there's stuff there. There's stuff there. I'm pleased with the stuff that's there. And the new Isthmus of Wong, the Isthmus of Wong coming out of the crucible of Ownershare, is a little bit leery, a little bit scared, a little bit uneasy about this world that he's adopted as his own, but he's also still in it. He's also still part of it. There is something about it that still calls him back to it. And exploring that as he discovers that a lot of what he knows about the Golden Age isn't actually true. I think that's going to make these next three books. I say three, I'm not sure it's going to be three. It may well be six. I don't know. I'm still working on a title for this first Seekers book. But I think it's going to be a better kind of grown-up Isthmus of Wong, a little more realistic. Slightly more jaded, certainly more skeptical. Which is, in a lot of ways, what happens to people. They grow up, they get burned, they learn lessons, they figure things out. And their perception of the world, their perception of the universe shifts over time. Sometimes it's very subtle. Sometimes it's pretty obvious. Sometimes it's a sharp break. Not to be confused with a psychic break, but it's fun. I'm at the point in the story where I need to keep writing because I really want to find out what happens next. Because I have no idea. And it's not until the words get on the page that I find out. So, there's that. And speaking of that, here I am at the back gate. Tomorrow's another day. And with any luck at all, I'll talk to you then.